In late July of 1933, a throng of 600 spectators crowded a Washington, D.C. auditorium for the NRA code hearing that would set the wages of 100,000 black iron and steel workers. But representatives of the from the NAACP were nowhere to be found. In fact, after listing the name and time of arrival of each of the five men in attendance, including himself, sociologist George Haynes sardonically observed, "Negroes present to care for the interests of the thousands of Negro workers were conspicuous by their scarcity." Two young unemployed men did make a carefully argued case for equal wages for black steel workers. Robert C. Weaver, a 25-year-old economics PhD candidate, and John P. Davis, then 28 and fresh out of Harvard Law School, were in the midst of a quixotic mission to represent the interests of millions of black industrial workers. Beginning their operations without funding as soon as the National Recovery Act became law in mid-June of 1933, and calling themselves the Negro Industrial League, Weaver and Davis boldly took on the bewildering bureaucratic apparatus of Roosevelt's most ambitious New Deal stimulus program by offering exhaustively researched briefs at hearings for industries with large percentages of black workers. The two-man operation was eventually endorsed by black church and fraternal organizations after they garnered press attention for their fierce challenges to the efforts of business, labor, and government to create codes that would further depress black workers' already low wages. But the Urban League equivocated and the NAACP hesitated, waiting to hear from informants dispatched by Walter White to check on Weaver and Davis. As July turned to August, the Negro Industrial League provided the only presentation on behalf of black workers at the soft coal hearing. Upon observing fewer than 10 black people among the 1,000 in attendance, George Haynes wrote to the members of the Federal Council of Churches that once again, quoting, "Negro workers were represented only by a corporal's guard." At this hearing, Nannie Helen Burroughs was the first nationally prominent person to aid the Negro Industrial League. Burroughs was both the founding president of a girls' school in Washington, D.C., and she was also the head of the National Baptist Women's Auxiliary, and many people called her the Black Goddess of Liberty. She provided the first public signal that the Negro Industrial League might become a black united front when she helped Robert Weaver make a dramatic presentation. She had obtained a telegram from Robert Russell Moton, the head of Tuskegee Institute, which gave the conservative educators support for equal pay scales. When Weaver used the telegram in his testimony, he effectively prevented the Southern coal industry from claiming that they had the support of major Southern black leaders for the pitifully low wages they proposed for black workers. Organized labor now began to support the Negro Industrial League as well. One newspaper report of the hearing proclaimed, "Moton's telegram creates sensation." And it said that when Weaver read it aloud, that John L. Lewis, then head of the United Mine Workers, pledged that the Negro Industrial League would have their support in the fight being waged for equal treatment of Negro workers. By the end of what was an unseasonably cool and rainy summer, Weaver and Davis were able to credibly claim that they represented more than a million black people, far exceeding the NAACP's shrinking membership by drawing on the help of Burroughs and an older black social scientist, Charles Wesley R. Wright Jr., and George Haynes, who himself had been a founder of the National Urban League, who garnered the support of Baptist men and women, all of the AMEs, the Elks, the Alphas, and the YWCA. Finally, in the fall of 1933, acceding from growing pressure from prominent race men and women to find a more lasting support for the shoestring efforts and getting rave reviews from his confidential informants, Walter White and the NAACP helped to establish and fund the Industrial League with a new name, the Joint Committee on Economic Recovery. This helped to end the gentleman's agreement that had been going on between the NAACP and the Urban League, that the Urban League would focus on labor and help propel the NAACP's efforts on labor for years to come. The Negro Industrial League's quick rise to prominence was one of three strong challenges to the NAACP's economic policies made by black social scientists and intellectuals during the Depression. While the NAACP initially met the challenge of these two young upstarts, the organization continued to spar with both Weaver and Davis over the next decade as both men became independent voices for black workers during the New Deal and the World War II. The other challenges to the failure of the NAACP to develop a very clear economic policies during the Depression came from within the organization itself. As its venerable crisis editor, W.E.B. Du Bois, stridently challenged the organization's economic and social policy, and economist Abram Harris, a board member, directed an ambitious effort to restructure the NAACP's programs to more directly address the needs of black working people. Throughout the critical years of the Depression and New Deal, this corporal's guard of younger black social scientists, lawyers, and activists sought to reframe the NAACP's programs and policies to emphasize economic justice for black workers, while Du Bois's increasingly querulous calls for a separate black economy placed him at odds with his friends and foes alike. The NAACP moved more forcefully into the area of labor, but with a wariness of both the left and of economic nationalism that would have even more fateful consequences for black workers during the Cold War. A more successful collaboration developed between the NAACP's Charles Hamilton Houston and black social scientists led by Harrison Weaver, who would help him amass the socioeconomic data for his labor and education lawsuits that were in process and would continue through the 1940s. W.E.B. Du Bois's audacious call for a segregated economy in the early 1930s helped provoke an even wider-ranging debate than Carter Woodson's contemporaneous demand that black people use segregation, as he called it, use segregation to kill segregation. Editorials in the crisis stressed the need for black self-reliance and extolled the potential virtues of a black consumer and cooperative movement. Du Bois first set forth many of these points in a 1930 speech, Education and Work, at Howard University. While both Woodson and Du Bois pointed to the college-educated elite as the seat of the problem, in Woodson's words, Du Bois felt that black people's lack of a collective economic action was a far more fundamental problem than did Woodson. Du Bois indicted black campuses as anti-intellectual strongholds, saying, "Our college man today is untouched by real culture, affecting to despise scholarship and the hard grind of study and research. The greatest meetings of the Negro college year have become vulgar exhibitions of liquor, extravagance, and fur coats." He called for a rededication to selfless ideals of poverty, work, knowledge, sacrifice, and beauty. And these, as most of us will recall, are very similar to Carter Woodson's ideas in the Miseducation of the Negro. Not so ironically, neither man would ever acknowledge that their ideas were in parallel. In a 1931 editorial, The Negro's Industrial Plight, Du Bois suggested a group effort to retain present employment, enter new fields of industrial technique, expand retail business, and live within our income. Now was the time, he proclaimed, for a black consumer movement targeted at stores without black employees, which would make, quote, a religion of our determination to spend our meager income in such ways that will bring us employment, end quote. By 1932, Du Bois had begun to suggest that segregation and Jim Crow were unbreachable barriers, and he argued that the only hope of black people was to build their own economic institutions in the form of nonprofit economic cooperatives under the guidance of black academics. One important flaw in Du Bois's nation within a nation schema was that it did not include industrial workers except as consumers, yet the plan was based largely on the assumption of the full cooperation of the black working class. One did not have to be a professional economist to question the viability or utility of a closed economic system which depended on wages earned from outside the system, whose principal businesses were retail stores, and which did not have the funds to promote economic development or create new jobs. The debate over Du Bois's call for voluntary segregation as a solution to the national economic crisis helped younger radical academics to come together in opposition to his program from the left. Sociologist E. Franklin Frazier led the chorus of black and white leftist scholars and intellectuals who attacked Du Bois's plan. By uncharitably characterizing Du Bois as a hopeless romantic mulatto who had probably outlived his usefulness as a social critic, Frazier slipped into the same type of color-coded insults that had demeaned Du Bois's own dispute with Marcus Garvey. Frazier scathingly attacked Du Bois's anti-materialistic call in which Du Bois asked black people to embrace the ideal of poverty as a share our poverty program. I will say that during the Cold War, E. Franklin Frazier was one of Du Bois's most steadfast supporters, so he did change. The economist Abram Harris should have been the loudest critic of Du Bois's plan, given his sharp opposition to Woodson's promotion of black business and his place of pride among the Howard radicals. But he pulled his punches publicly with Du Bois because he was hoping to transform the NAACP into an organization that better served black workers' concerns. And he also hoped to keep Du Bois on as editor of The Crisis. So Harris did not openly break with Du Bois, but the idea of a separate economy program was an anathema to Harris. Accordingly, he wrote to Du Bois to explain privately and gently that he would not support his program. Du Bois's program had its most critical reception from the NAACP's national board, which had employed him since its founding. Du Bois's editorial independence and expenses were longstanding organizational concerns. The board was now infuriated by his editorials on segregation in the crisis and moved to curb his autonomy and provoke his departure. Their support of the Joint Committee on Economic Recovery also undercut Du Bois's public indictment that the NAACP, quote, finds itself at this time of crisis without a program, without effective organization, without executive officers who have either the ability or disposition to guide it in the right direction, unquote. His critique of the NAACP's rather anemic economic program was actually lost in the debate over voluntary segregation and Du Bois's resignation. In the summer of 1934, Du Bois relinquished his positions at the NAACP as Director of Publications and Research and Editor of the Crisis. He formally rejoined the faculty of Atlanta University and leaving the task of changing the NAACP to Abram Harris. Harris spearheaded an attempt in 1934 and 35 to reorganize the NAACP. As a member of the board of directors, he had failed to avert Du Bois's resignation, but now Walter White named him chair of the Committee on the Plan and Program of the Association and the Future of the Crisis. This committee had only one other member who was firmly in the Du Bois camp, Howard University English professor Sterling Brown. But Harris outmaneuvered its most conservative members by appointing his political allies to special advisory subcommittees that prepared the final report. One of his strongest allies was Charles Hamilton Houston. One of Harris's early suggestions that would have carried forth both the Younger Radicals' economic program and continued Du Bois's association with the Crisis would have created a new five-member editorial board that would have included Du Bois, Frazier, Walter White, but White was absolutely adamant that Du Bois have no more relationship with the Crisis, so that part was quashed. Other allies that Harris had included William Pickens and William Hasty, and they argued that the NAACP needed then to become more appealing to, quote, the man on the street. The committee unveiled its proposals at the 1935 annual meeting in St. Louis, which we've heard earlier had a number of things mm-hmm. happening. This meeting must have, thank you, I'm almost done, must have alarmed the moderates on the board because the Howard Radicals were in full control of the program, which emphasized new economic initiatives, support of industrial unions, and workers' educations. Furthermore, the conference delegates were very receptive to calls for societal change, which came from the podium. They enthusiastically reacted to the speech by Howard Kester, white socialist organizer from the Southern Farm Tenants Union, John P. Davis, now the director of the Joint Committee on Economic Recovery, made the main address. A fiery call to arms, which was widely publicized and gave Davis the national audience that he wanted as he created the National Negro Congress that same year. The main provisions in the report call for a reorientation of the NAACP's programmatic focus from civil liberties towards specific activities in the economic area, the most important of which was to be the inauguration of workers' education courses in the branches, and also that the branches would have more control over the choice of national board members. What happened, and to make a long story short, is that the report was completely accepted without any alteration, but then Walter White never fully implemented it. Nevertheless, some education courses were given. The national office was more involved in economic issues than ever before, and the local branches got more say in the makeup. And these efforts by younger black social scientists helped move the NAACP toward what would become very important activities on behalf of black workers and labor. Thank you.